General Government Committee, good to see you all. The sun is shining. Catch it, because I think it's going back to rain soon. If you have a cell phone or a PDA or anything that makes noise, please turn it off. Otherwise, if I hear it, I'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. If you're here to testify today, the sign-up sheets are on the side table. And we're taking these bills in different orders today based on who is here available at certain times to testify. So our first bill up today, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 686. Ms. Richardson, tell us about that bill, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 686 defines a private alternative education program as an alternative education program that accepts tuition payments from at least 50% of the parents and guardians of participating students. It allows resident school districts with the approval of students' parents or guardians to enroll students in the public or private alternative education program. It removes the requirement to notify the resident district of enrollment in the alternative education program. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Lively Brooks. You're the only person signed up to testify, and it is your bill, so come on up.
My name is Dean Lively Brooks, and I'm an 8-year member of the Crow-Apple Gate and Lorraine School District Board of Directors, and I'm also a senior physics instructor at the University of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill this morning. The purpose of this very small piece of legislation or proposed legislation is to seek clarifications regarding the standards for private alternative education providers. As you're well aware, the standards regarding regular public schools are quite high. We have standards regarding the qualifications of staff at those places. We have regular benchmarks in language arts, math, and eventually hopefully science taking place in grades 3 through 8 and grades 10. In other words, we have a system in place that ensures that these institutions are accountable regarding the way they seek to educate our children. Alternately, the standards for private alternative education providers under the ORS 336 subsections are really quite low. Indeed, there is absolutely no requirement that any of the teaching staff at a private alternative education provider be certified, let alone possess a degree, a specialty degree within their area of expertise or area of instruction. And so I wrote this to try to seek some clarification as to what constitutes seeking a better definition, essentially, for what constitutes a private alternative education provider, because I'm really wary of the low standards that are associated with those organizations and feel that is an improper use of public funds to fund those organizations with such low standards and such lax accountability standards. So the proposed language addresses this in one way, definitional, trying to define what is a private alternative education provider. Now, the history of this goes back to last summer when we were visited by some representatives from HomeSource, which is a self-declared private alternative education provider in the Eugene area, which provides publicly funded educational services to homeschool students. The HomeSource adopted a board policy to only accept students that had public funding. In other words, by their own board policy, they were only funded by public funds. And yet they claim to also be a private alternative education provider because of their status as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And as a board member, this really bothered me because essentially what they wanted was a way to compel us to enter contracts with their program under the argument that if we didn't, the students residing within our district wouldn't be able to attend their organization on one hand, and on the other hand, they wanted to have the lowest possible standards regarding the regarding their instructional staff. And as a, you know, 8-year board member, this really bothered me, frankly. The public funds that follow these students basically come out of the state school fund, and the net effect is to reduce the overall school funding level for students that are attending regular public schools. And it bothered me that we would be sending money, public funds, to follow these students to home source, and essentially our regular school students would be paying for that in the form of larger class sizes and things like that. Now, I know the numbers are fairly small, but if the situation persists, there's nothing to say in the future these numbers couldn't grow. Numbers meaning the numbers of students, homeschool students, that are seeking public funding and going to private alternative education providers. So one example of how bad the situation could possibly be, I spoke with deputy superintendent at the Department of Education, who told me that the ADMW, the way the rules and regulations average daily membership are written, if a student basically receives 1 hour of one-on-one instruction daily, that student qualifies for the full ADMW for that day. And so we have a situation essentially where, you know, I'll paint the worst case scenario. It's obviously not representative, but we could have a homeschool student taking private horseback riding lessons for an hour a day and receiving full ADMW from the state for that effort. And again, this really concerns me, and so I seek clarification. And another big problem regarding the alternate education providers is accountability and standards, and this language in this bill doesn't seek to address this other than to set essentially a higher definitional bar for what constitutes a private alternative education provider. The other language change that I proposed is intended to clarify the process by which public funds will follow homeschool students to said alternative education providers. I would hate to see the state set up a situation where it would indemnify the decisions to publicly fund homeschool students based solely on the determination, or based on the determination made solely by the homeschool parents. This concerns me because in all other aspects of our educational system, we have systems in place that expect some demonstrable educational expertise from the individuals who place students in various specialized programs. And so I wanted to clarify that language, and that was my intention with the other piece of language in this proposed bill. So essentially, this bill seeks to clarify those two things. An alternate way to get my wishes regarding the definition of private alternative education providers, of course, would be to simply, in statute, raise the bar regarding the qualifications of staff at those institutions, and also setting up systems of accountability. But this was basically an alternate way and a simpler way to try to achieve that same purpose. And that's all I have to say at this time. I'm ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lively Brooks. We have, colleagues, you have a large packet at your desk here. We got a number of emails sent to our committee administrator.
Yes.
From private alternative education providers who wonder what you're doing with this bill, what you're trying to fix, and they're pretty upset about it.
Yes.
Think you've just clarified on the record what you are attempting to do. So I'm going to ask if the committee has any questions. No. There aren't any questions today, Mr. Lively Brooks. I think that what we need to do, I just saw this packet today, is we need to take a look at it and talk about it and see if there's any additional questions. I appreciate your service, and I appreciate that you drove up here today. It's actually a nice day. I hope it's not raining in the Eugene area. Not that I would ever care, because I don't live there half the time anymore when I'm up here, but It is nice when the sun shines, and I'm glad that you had a nice drive up.
I appreciate the opportunity to come up and testify in your consideration of this bill.
Yeah. And all right, well, thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I
guess there is one question.
No question. I just point out for the record that in this packet we got, the first letter is from Carol Smith, Chief of Staff of Portland Public Schools. So they aren't all from alternative school folks. There are actual school folks. There's a couple letters from community colleges as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that correction. And so we're going to need to review the letters and see what the issue is. All right. Thank you.
Do you need me for that?
No. Okay. No, we'll just take a look at these in our mini spare hours that we have here in the legislature and get back to you.
All right. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, sir. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 755.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 755 specifies the quorum for Pilot Education Service District Board. It allows Pilot Education Service District Board member to be recalled, provides for staggered termination of service for board members, extends their legislative reporting requirement, and allows an appointed board member to promote or oppose candidates for a political measure in the same manner as an elected board member until the year 2012, declares an emergency and takes effect upon passage.
I only have one person signed up to speak on this bill, and I know there's one more. So you need to come on forward. Ozzy Rose and Mr. Mabbitt.
I'm assuming this is one of the technical fixes.
This is a technical fix, Senator Cruz, yes, to a bill that you and I were very involved in last session. So we'll see what it is they'd like us to change, and you and I will decide whether that, and the committee will decide whether that's something we want to do. So, gentlemen, who'd like to go first?
We're going different directions, so I think you should.
I know, you're opposed, so I'll take.
I'll be happy to go first.
Great, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jim Mabbitt. I'm superintendent of the Northwest Regional Education Service District, and I should begin for apologizing for my absence last week, and I thank the committee for its patience and postponing the hearing until today. Last session, House Bill 3184 mandated that three ESDs, High Desert, Willamette, and Northwest, adopt a pilot governance model. That model defined a board which consists of five elected members that are elected by local school district boards and four appointed board members. The four appointed board members were to have one come from each of the areas of higher education, social services, the business community, and one at large. After that particular bill passed, we did discover that we needed to kind of take license, if you will, in order to rezone and create an elections process and so forth, because those things were not outlined in the bill, but we were very successful in doing that. We worked closely with the Oregon Department of Education, and the three ESDs worked very closely together, and the three boards at that time. And by the way, just a note, all three boards, even though their terms were going to expire due to that, to the passage of that bill, all three boards embraced that concept and said, let's make the best of this, and let's make this transition a smooth one. And I want to give them credit here in the record. They were fabulous, all three of those boards in embracing the legislation. The process went very well, and our school districts voted. Each district had one vote in their zone, and we wound up with five elected board members from those districts. The appointments followed, and those went well also. And I think the intent of what was desired by the legislature is actually happening, because we do have strong representation now on our board from the community college, one of the community colleges in our region, the business community, social services, and it's been helpful to our board as a whole. The purpose of this bill, however, Senate Bill 755, is to look at four problems with the bill that I think need to be repaired, and they're simple fixes. in my view, to take care of what the problems are with the bill. It's obviously not the content of the bill, but it's just the details that are in it. I also want to advise the committee that I'm in an interesting position because I am president-elect of the Oregon Association of ESDs, and because these are three pilots, there's 17 other ESDs. The organization is not supportive of this bill because they're not involved in it, and the concern is that they like things the way they are, and they could change. So I wanted to advise you that I have that kind of dual role, and it's put me in somewhat of an uncomfortable position. But I want you to
I think Mr. Rose will be able to represent that uncomfortable part of you.
I have no doubt about that. And
he set his alarm clock today.
Exactly.
And he's wearing an Oregon Duck tie, so he's hoping that will.
Now, I believe those are mutually exclusive. but I will mention that it's extremely important to the three pilots that these corrections be made.
Okay.
So I'll go through them very quickly.
All right.
The four corrections that need to be made. One is that when each pilot came to the election of their five elected board members, we realized that we had a problem because the board was going to be an eventual nine board. But when we had our five elected, the AG's office informed us that those five were a quorum, and the five had to be the majority of the eventual board. So in all the business that was being done by the three ESDs, prior to the appointments being made, we had to have unanimous decisions, every one of those decisions on a board. And I think you know that that's just not good public policy. And there's an easy way to fix that, which I'll go over after I go through the issues. The second issue is there's no provision for recall, because these board members are not publicly elected, and so therefore the law only allows for a recall of publicly elected officials, and so we need a recall provision, and we have a fix for that. Third, there are no staggered terms. All nine of the board members' terms expire June 30th of 2010, and I want to remind you that all of my past board terms expired June 30th of 2006. It would be a shame for an organization to go through a massive change in a board within 4 years, have two changes like that. It's not good for an organization, I can assure you. So we have a fix for that, but I also have a subnote that I want to mention to that when I get to that point. And finally, because of a 1993 AG's opinion that talked about public state commissions, state commission members were not allowed to take stances on state measures or candidates running for election. As you know, school board members and ESD board members all over the state can take stances on those issues. But in this case, our board members were not allowed to, for instance, in last November's election. Consequently, that needs to be fixed, and there's an easy fix for that as well. And just a side note there, so you know when I get to that point, the way the AG defined it back then, and it stands today, is that anyone serving on a commission is treated as a public employee when it comes to taking stances on measures and candidates. We can fix that. So the four fixes, I want to refer you to the bill, Senate Bill 755. Beginning on line 30 of page 1, the very bottom of page 1, we look at the quorum issue, and this would take care of any issues in the future if there were future pilots, or this language could also take care of if these boards were put into some permanent language. The way to fix that is to take the five directors that are elected, or just say the five directors are a quorum, and a majority of the quorum may conduct business. That, therefore, three out of the five could be making decisions instead of having that unanimous decision of those elected members. The second fix has to do with recall, and that begins on line 17 of page 2, 17 through 20. And what we would do there is simply say, since school district boards elected those five original board members, they ought to be able to recall them as well. And so a majority vote of those school boards could recall one of those elected board members. And since the appointed members are appointed by the five elected members, they should be able to be recalled then by those five elected members. So that would be a simple fix for the recall issue. The staggered term issue is a little more complicated. It begins on line 40 of page 2. And I want to tell you the problem that we're up against here. To avoid having our entire boards go off June 30th of 2010, we've got to have fixed this somehow in terms of staggered terms. I believe we need to fix this session. It's fair to the current sitting members to make sure they understand what their terms are and what their futures are in terms of serving on those boards. The language that's in the bill right now suggests that we could have approximately half of the board go off at the end of 2008, June 30th, 2008, and the remainder go off June 30th, 2010 as they're scheduled now. That would set up a 2-year staggering and it would work fine. The problem is that over the last several weeks, we've been having discussions between the three pilot ESDs, and there's some concern from one of the ESDs in particular that those members who took office just this year might go off so soon, in June 30th of 08. And so they've been trying to come up with an alternative as to how it could work. And last night they proposed an alternative that I promised I would share with you that I don't have any problem with. I just want to get this done this session in terms of staggered. In order to delay getting these staggered terms in place, in other words, they don't go off in 08, we would have half of them go off, and this is not in the bill, we would have half of them go off in 09. The folks who replace them would have a one-time 3-year term, so those terms would expire in 2012. The remainder would go off as planned in 2010, and therefore 4 years after that would be 2014, and we'd have that 2-year staggering. Obviously, the exception here with this bill is there's a delay, and the replacements have that one-time kind of 3-year term that you'd have to put into the bill. That's the alternative. Those are the only two ideas we have. And I can tell you I can live with either one of them. But to have the three pilots in agreement, the second idea is the one that we would suggest. I also want to make sure you're aware, my ESD board is okay with either one of those. The other two ESD boards have not weighed in on this, but I'm told they will within 1 week from now, and we'd be able to come back with a solid answer about the three pilots being in agreement. The fourth issue has to do with what I mentioned, board members not being able to take stances on political issues or candidates. And on page 3 of the bill, lines 37 through 39, it's a simple fix, just taking that definition of public employee and state that it not only does it not include an elected official, but it also does not include a director of a pilot ESD. And that would allow those board members to have the same rights as other ESD board members and school district board members in the state to take stances on those measures and candidates.
Okay. That was a great presentation, Mr. Mabbitt. Thank you. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, on the staggered terms, let me just throw something else out that might give it even more stability, would be to move the 2010 dates to 2012 and the 2008 date to 2010. That would give you a little more consistency in the startup rather than really tinkering with it, because that section just references the startup anyway. So just a thought.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, are you suggesting that the terms of the current members would expire in 2010 and then 2012?
Right.
There is a problem with that in that we can't, the Oregon Constitution does not allow a board member's term to go beyond 4 years, and so the current members could not extend beyond 2010.
Okay.
Okay. We have
scratch
a little
that.
Problem with that one. Oh, any questions from down here? Okay.
I just want to know how Ozzie could possibly be opposed to that. So I'm anxious to hear the opposite.
Yeah, we're quite anxious ourselves. So, Mr. Rose, you're on deck.
Actually, he's up to the plate, I believe.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Oregon Association of ESDs. And much like last week, I'm taking a position different than two or three of the ESDs that are testifying, with one exception. Much of what Mr. Mabbitt has said, all parties agree to. But the two pilots don't all agree with what he said either. The pilot districts were established to test a new way of governing ESDs. That was a big discussion last time, which the two of you are very familiar with. Specifically, we were interested in assuring more oversight of the ESDs and more control by the component districts of what ESDs did. That led to the governance structure of five elected board members, or five, they call them appointed by the local districts, and four additional ones added. That process at the present time appears to have worked very well. The new boards have only been operational since September of 06. They are just now developing their first budget. All of the proposed changes in 755 appear to have merit, but can be made in 2009 when you evaluate this pilot project. You have some choices to make in 2009. I assume when we did the pilot concept, we were doing it in good faith, that it was a test of some new ideas. And in 2009, you're going to have to make some decisions. Do you do you extend the concept to all 20 ESDs? Do you revert the three back to the what it used to be? Do you leave them the way they are and let the 17 others choose what they want to be? I mean, depending on what you do about evaluating, what you learn about this process, you have those decisions to make. And all the issues that Jim has raised, the quorum, the staggered terms, the number of zones, the recall, and the boards not being able to express themselves on political measures are all accurate. The only one of those that needs to be fixed before 2009 is the reference to can the boards express themselves on a measure, and that's because of the 2008 election's coming up. And that's Section 6 and 7 of the bill. And to illustrate the argument is that you shouldn't try to fix parts of it, and then we come back in 2009 and try to fix other parts. We should wait and look at the total experiment and then fix all of it at once. And the last discussion regarding zones in the bill, the proposal in the bill calls for 7 to 11 zones. But it's been pointed out they've gone to 5 and would like to stay at 5. So we need to correct that. Correction. The last issue about staggered terms. Jim shared with you what he perceives a discussion of what the other pilot ESDs was. I've been talking to him here, and I have a different perception of what that conversation is. And again, that's because we're doing it by telephone and so forth. The other approach that I think makes more sense in the staggered terms issue, in 2009, when you evaluate the total program, if you decide not to go forward, then it's over with. But if you decide to go forward, then extend half of those people's terms for 2 years. And so their terms now go to 2010. And you could, and notwithstanding the reference to what the Constitution says, the ESDs are a creation of this body. And you fired all the ESD board members last time. So I would assume you have the authority to change their term next time. And so we would argue that in 2009, you would extend half of their terms for 2 years to 2012, have the rest of them stand for election for a four-year term, and you'd be off on a two-year staggered term, half of them elected in 2012, half of them in 2010, and then 14, 16, et cetera. And so the point is that if you're going to truly look at this as a pilot and then make some judgments, you need to let it function. Even at 2009, these boards will only have been in as board members for 2.5 years. They would have made up 3 budgets. And so you need to give it a chance to work and work properly before you start making changes. That's
well, Mr. Rose, I appreciate that, but let me ask you, I was trying to think of which ones we really need fixed now, and I would agree with you, the right to free speech by these employees should be back into the bill, but I'm sensing that the quorum issue is a problem right now.
The quorum issue is only an issue when the board start up. They've got their members now.
Only when they start up. When they only had five,
how do you do it? But they've all got their 9. And that has to be fixed before you extend this proposal to any other issue. We agree with that. But again, you can fix it in 2009 mm-hmm. before you... I think you have to, if it was truly a pilot, leave open the door that maybe you don't extend it.
Well, and that is true. We may find the experiment doesn't work, but I was pleased to hear Mr. Babbitt say that they had embraced it with enthusiasm, so to speak.
With all the respect, I think all 3 SDs will say that. It's gone very, very well to date.
Yeah, they were.
6+ months.
They went kicking and screaming, but I'm glad to hear that you just sucked it up and went forward, because we really believed in the concept, and so did the legislature when they passed the bill. And so I'm glad that we're actually going to be able to have an objective standard to judge by whether this worked or not, because if you hadn't been cooperative, it wouldn't have worked.
Right. Maybe we could change kicking and screaming to reluctant caution or something like that.
Okay. We don't need...
Reasonable caution.
Reasonable caution. That sounds good. Senator Cruz, since you were my partner in crime last session on this, what's your thoughts?
Well, I think Ozzie probably makes some good points. Everything would still be in place. I guess I'm... You know, I agree with the free speech provision. I think that's important that we do that, so these folks mm-hmm. have the right to opine on issues. That's clearly important. You know, I would say the recall section is probably important, but I guess I would seriously doubt that we would reach a point of recall before 2009. So, I mean, we knew, Madam Chair. We knew there were deficiencies in the bill. We knew when we looked at it that we should have had staggered terms. There are several things that should have been in the bill, but due to the lateness of the session and other things going on, we let it go as was.
I agree, all of us were here last session. It was one of the bills towards the end. It failed on the House floor. Brought back to life, and we just weren't interested in making any more changes at that time. But unless the committee is sensing that we need to rush into these changes before 09, I'm getting the sense that we just want to make the one fix, Mr. Mabbitt. And can you respond to that?
Yes, I'd like to. One note on Mr. Rose's testimony, and all due respect to him, I think he's unaware that last night from my home I had conversations with the other 2 ESD superintendents, and the fix on staggered terms that I explained to you that's not in the bill, mm-hmm. we have agreement on. So I want to clarify that point. But I also want to speak about my board. My board apparently is one of the 3 boards that has discussed this staggered term issue in detail. And the bottom line is that they want to know what their future holds. They would like to know what their terms are going to be. They realize that, and I've told them that I believe the legislature is going to stagger those terms in some fashion. We already know what the options are to fix this. We've got to do the one fix, which I think everyone's in agreement on, it appears anyway, on the free speech issue. I suggest the recall issue is important. It ought to be there for all elected officials, and it should be there. the staggered terms one is important for members to know what their terms actually are while they're serving. And the one I would agree on that could wait, because we don't know where this is going to go, is the quorum issue. That's not one that needs to be repaired right now. But Ozzie and I are in agreement, I believe, that yes, we should fix these all at once. I say now. He says 2 years from now.
I say tomato, he says tomato. Okay, well, we've exhausted our time today, unless any members of the committee. Senator Morse, you have this really studious look on your face.
Yeah, I'm sure, thank you. If this is, in fact, a pilot project to be evaluated in 2009, I don't see the risk of fixing it so it works with a sense of permanency. We can always evaluate it and change it at that time. But there's been a lot of work done right now. I don't see where we back up if we put these corrections into place now, yeah, as opposed to 2009.
Okay, that's good to hear. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I'm going to agree to a degree with Senator Morris. I mean, the free speech clearly, and if we do hear directly from the three pilots that the staggered terms is something that gives them a level of comfort, because we've already made them uncomfortable by doing this. I would be interested in that. The quorum issue, I don't want to deal with. That needs to be very specific language dealing with startups if we expand the program.
Right.
And it's a piece that needs to be there and go away once the startup has been done. And quite honestly, the recall may be an important issue, but I'm not sure that it's, you know, my thing.
Well, I mean, if we don't do it, they're forced to live with someone that's not working out.
Well, I mean, that's your call, Madam Chair, on that one, but
okay.
You know, we've asked these folks to step out, and they have done that. And in my opinion, I think we're going to find this model to be incredibly successful and be moving towards expansion. It's, of course, that's my opinion, and I'm just a senator.
But Senator Morse's point is well taken, that if we want this to be expanded, then let's try to solve some of these problems. So what I'm going to do, Senator Cruz, is I'm going to put you in charge of meeting with some folks and trying to come up with some agreements that we can all live with and bring it back to the committee, okay, and we'll go from there. Does that sound good?
Madam Chair, I promise it won't be as long or as all-encompassing a work group as last session.
No, I think you can hammer this out in about 30 minutes outside the hearing room to just try to nail down the language. But you get the sense of where the committee is, and that's what I wanted you to know. So it's not considered a backroom deal. It's a... You know where we want to go, and we know where you want to go. So that's a good thing.
That's right.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
The record and my own credibility, the last phone call I had last night was reflected in my testimony.
All right. Well, thank you. That's
so awesome. I'll compare times outside.
All right. That's fine, gentlemen. Thank you. We'll close you the public hearing on Senate Bill 755. We will now go on and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 822. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 822 revises the process for giving veterans and disabled veterans preference in civil service employment and promotion. It requires a public employer to appoint a veteran or disabled veteran to a vacant position if the results of the application examination are equal to or higher than other applicants. It allows veterans or disabled veterans to use a preference or the preference more than once. It requires a written explanation be provided to a veteran or disabled veteran that's given preference but not appointed to a vacant position. It specifies that failure to give a veteran or disabled veteran preference in the promotion is an unlawful employment practice with a right of appeal to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It allows a civil action for failure to comply with preference requirements. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage. We also have a -1 amendment in front of us that clarifies the definition of a veteran who served on active duty.
I did see that yesterday. I do like that -1 amendment. It sounds less punitive than the other one. So let's bring up some folks, Robert Thornhill and Mac McDonald and Paula Brown. If I can get all three of you at once. Mm-hmm. Okay, who would like to start out this morning?
Mr. Thornhill.
Okay.
Madam Chairman.
Mr. Thornhill, identify yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I appear before you in my capacity as chairman of Oregon VFW's Employment and Civil Service Committee, an unpaid volunteer position, and as a member of Portland's VFW Post 1442 and Beaverton's American Legion Post 124. I appear in support of Senate Bill 822. And with your permission, I'll read a summary of my testimony.
Okay. A summary of your testimony, because your testimony is several pages. You're not reading all that, are you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. Summary.
All right. Well, I will read.
I was told I might have only 1 minute, so
yeah,
I'll
okay.
try to get it down to about four.
Well, thank you. I will read all your testimony, but if you can condense it down, that would be
thank
fabulous.
You very much,
thank you.
Since the time of the Civil War, veterans have been given some degree of preference for appointment to federal civil service position. The current preference system stems from the Veterans Preference Act of 1944. As a former director of personnel for several U.S. Army commands, I know the act has served the nation and veterans well. It has attracted well-qualified, seasoned, disciplined veterans with proven leadership and teamwork skills to the federal workforce. The federal workforce today comprised of 25% veterans. Oregon has adopted veterans' preference as public policy. Its statutes presently prescribe a form of veterans' preference. However, it is preference in name only, as it does not, in practice, provide any meaningful preference. Moreover, the current system does not provide for any transparency. Even if the system provided preference, the veteran would never know if he had received it. And even if she had not, there is no avenue of redress, thus no enforcement. Oregon's veteran preference system contains an implied promise of real, meaningful preference. However, as indicated, it is an empty, false promise. Now is the time to give meaning to that promise. To quote from Governor Kulongoski's May 2006 Memorial Day address, quote, "All veterans deserve every laurel, every honor, every tribute, and every word of praise this nation can bestow. But ceremonies and solemn words, no matter how heartfelt, are not enough. We must not pay real service with lip service." End of quote. The current Oregon system of veterans' preference is no more than lip service to the principle of veterans' preference. Senate Bill 822 makes the promise of veterans' preference real and meaningful. It contains several important features of Title V of the United States Code, which have made Veterans Preference Act of 1944 so effective. Among them is the most important requirement that an appointing official may not pass over a veteran or disabled veteran to hire a non-veteran with lower qualifications evaluation. The federal system has been tested and proven effective for over a half a century. In sum, Senate Bill 822 has the elements necessary for an effective and meaningful system of providing preference to veterans. And in doing so, it imposes no undue, onerous, bureaucratic burden on management. In testifying, I've tried to express the strong support of this bill of my many comrades sitting behind me, to include VFW State Commander Dan Wakefield and past Commander Tom Lang, District 3 Commander George Winslow, American Legion Post Commander Marv Doty, and so on. As you can see, this bill is not for us, because we're rather mature. We've had our day.
I love that description, mature. That's very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoy that better than old man. Yeah. No, this is not for us.
Mature and experienced.
Thank you. But for the men and women bearing the brunt of our nation's current battles in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the war on terror. They are Oregon's sons and daughters, spouses, our brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, and yes, our grandchildren. They deserve what this bill provides. Members of the committee, Madam Chairman, men and women in uniform don't have the option of choosing their wars. To quote from Lord Tennyson's famous poem, "Not theirs to make reply, not theirs to question why, theirs but to do and die." And as with the Light Brigade of that poem, American men and women in uniform today are doing their job and doing it well. And they deserve what this bill provides. Unfortunately, some will not come home alive. I do not know if original with him, but in this regard, my friend and comrade, George Winslow, behind me, frequently repeats the saying, honor the dead by caring for the living. SB 822 is one small way of honoring the dead by taking care of the living, and especially of those who come home less than whole. I urge its passage. In concluding the summary, I want to thank Senator Deckert and Representative Barker and Bocist for introducing this bill, and I especially want to thank their staff and the staff of the Legislative Council who labor anonymously but make things happen. Thank you for holding this hearing and for hearing me out. And I welcome any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That was very eloquent testimony.
Thank you.
And I am inclined to read it all now because your summary was wonderful. And thank you for thanking those anonymous people in Legislative Council who labor constantly to make things right for us. So it was great. And I know this committee was very moved by your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Who would like to go next?
I'll go next. Madam Chair, members mm-hmm. of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. As Mr. Thornhill has indicated, the veterans preference enacted by Congress was enacted to prevent veterans seeking federal employment from being penalized for their time in military service. It was designed to give veterans preference to recognize the economic loss by citizens who served their country in uniform. It was a way to help make up for the economic loss they suffered in answering this nation's call to arms. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is the state's advocate for veterans, their dependents, and survivors. And as such, the department would be supportive of efforts such as Senate Bill 822 to enhance or expand services to veterans. Senate Bill 822 does exactly that. It seeks to enhance the employment preference. Currently in Oregon, the veterans preference system primarily is applied to the interview process. Veterans are awarded the veterans preference points, and as a result, often are able to get an interview that they may not otherwise get. That is pretty much where the veterans preference in Oregon does stop, because from the interview process on, then veterans are competing among a pool of candidates regardless of the preference points. The preference points are primarily used to grant the veteran the interview. So to conclude, just to keep it short, I think Mr. Thornhill did do a very good job in summarizing, and I have read his complete testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but the department is supportive of additional benefits in Oregon that result in employment. We are seeing, as we have the veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, that one of the number one concerns they have is employment. Mm-hmm. And with that, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer those.
Okay,
great. Thank you very much.
Let's hear from Mr. McDonald then.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mac McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which is every federally chartered veterans organization in the state and some that are not chartered. I'd like to give you two examples of why we need this bill. After World War II, Seiji Nikashawa came back to this state, went to Lewis and Clark University on the GI Bill, got his degree and applied to the state for employment. After his interview was over, the man interviewer told him, "We don't hire Japs." Luckily, it was overheard. Sagey spent the next 30 years working for the state. Another instance, a gentleman came back from the armed forces, applied for a job in training in one of the state departments. He had a master's degree in education. He had taught at the Naval Academy and at the Canadian Forces College. He had taught at elementary school before he went in the service. He had worked at Marine Corps schools, setting up programs, etc. The other gentleman considered for the job had a high school degree, a high school diploma, went to Chemeca, had a few courses, had never worked in training. When the choice came for the interviewer to select the person to hire, he hired the other person. And I was the other person on the other side. I went to the interviewer and said, "What did I do wrong?" He looked at me straight in the eye and said, "We've had veterans here before and they don't do a very good job. That's why I hired the other person." I had no recourse. I was done. I went on to teach math at North High School, ran the high school program for Marin County Family Court, and retired as the principal of the alternative high school at Woodburn Jervis North Marion Alternative High School. But that's the reason we need this bill, because veterans have been discriminated against in the past. Hopefully it won't happen in the future, but those are just two cases that I know of out of personal experience. We need this bill to ensure that veterans at least get an even break. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. I will ask my committee if there are any questions. You've all been so eloquent this morning. Any questions?
Great.
Okay. I'm glad you didn't give up, Mr. McDonald.
Oh, I enjoy young people. I had a great job.
Yeah, you just poked him right in the eye and said, "I'm going to go get a job I like." So thank you. Thank all three of you. All right, I'd like to call up Representative Boquist. Senator Deckert was here a moment ago. Maybe he'll pop back in. And Mr. Evans, I think there's a question that's come up.
That's on the Constitution.
That's right, left side. That's appropriate. Right. Actually, we should switch. That way you
so
go right
stage
left. Left. Right. Okay, got it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm Representative Brian Boquist, 23rd House District, a member of the Veterans Committee, and also a sponsor of an exact duplicate bill in the House in which we are not moving, anticipating the leadership of this committee of pushing a bill over to us. I do appreciate just a moment to talk about this program. The federal program has been in place for obviously decades. I believe there are a few technical changes that various agencies and individuals would like to make to the bill.
And that's why Mr. Evans is here.
And I believe that those are amenable and that we worked out by the leadership of the chair here and the members of this committee. And having said that, if that doesn't work out, we'll work it out on the House when it comes to ours. Because as I did mention, Chair Barker is the chair of the Veterans Committee and he is the sponsor of this bill over here. And with that, I'm going to let my colleague in arms from the military in a different life take over.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Evans, welcome.
Thank
Good
you,
to
Madam
see
Chair.
You. Welcome
Good
back
to
Oregon.
Basically, I was called about 10 minutes ago and told that the bill was coming up.
Yes, you were. This is your duty under stress. We're going to see how well you do under stress.
Well, the beautiful part about this particular situation is that Representative Boquist is absolutely correct. There are some issues that were raised in the last couple of days that are more technical than anything else. The intent of trying to bring the state standard up to the federal standard, I think that there's not a lot of debate about. But in the last, actually the last day, I got an email from the human resources folks over at DAS saying that there's a technical language issue that needs to be talked about that we are scheduled to talk about tomorrow. And I can get back to you the details of that as soon as I can.
Okay.
Unfortunately, again, I apologize having to say that. Give us a little more time. But in this particular case, we want to make sure that we measure twice and cut once.
Gosh, there's a lot of great lines coming out of these folks this morning. I love it. And I was trying to look for the quote that Mr. Thornhill read from the governor about. I didn't write it down because I thought, oh, right here, we must not repay real service with lip service. I love that quote this morning.
The governor is committed to those
and
ideals.
I assume the governor's very committed to this bill. Okay, great. Well, we're going to let you work out the little problem with Department of Administrative Services, and you'll keep Representative Boquist in the loop so we can take a leadership role in the Senate and get it fixed over here. Any questions from the committee? Okay, and I don't... Is Senator Dirk not able to... Okay, he's got committee himself. And, okay, we have written testimony of Senator Deckert, so please make note of that. And, gentlemen, thank you very much. And, Mr. Evans, let us know when you get that problem taken
yes, ma'am.
Care of.
Thank
Mr. McDonald, you're in the back. Come on up. You're raising your hand.
Madam Chair, I just want to ask...
state your name for the record,
my
sir.
My name is Mac McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon.
Okay.
I propose three changes to the bill. First page, lines 20, 22, and 24, to say that we're discharged under honorable conditions.
We have that dash one amendment, yeah. What I'll do, though, is hold that because I think there's some other technical change, and so we'll just combine the two amendments if we might, or we'll just take them all up at once.
I just want to ensure, because the way this is written, to some of the bad conduct discharge or an undesirable discharge could apply.
I noticed that, and I
and
yeah.
This, the change will make it you have to be discharged under honorable conditions.
Thank you for explaining that. And Senator Deckert's office did share that amendment with me yesterday. Okay, well, we'll wait for the folks to come back with a technical fix to make this bill even better. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 822. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 448.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 448 originally directed the Department of Education to review the long-term viability of state institutions of higher education. It would have declared an emergency and taken effect July 1st, 2007. However, that's not really at all the bill that we're considering today. The Dash 1 amendments will be reminiscent of a bill that we heard in February regarding the multicultural student educator, what was then a loan program, but under Senate Bill 448 and the Dash 1 amendment is now a voucher program. It appropriates $500,000 from the general fund for the 2007-2009 biennium and provides the service award vouchers for service as a teacher in an Oregon school district, provides a higher voucher amount and a shorter period of required employment for teaching in a low-income area school or as a guidance counselor, mathematics, science, second language, reading, or special education teacher. It defines eligible participants and selection factors, identifies permissible uses of vouchers, provides guidelines for completing an employment requirement. I have in my hands Dash 2 amendments that are new to me and new to you, so we can look at those as well. The bill currently does not have a subsequent referral.
Okay, we just got these Dash 2 amendments. They are hot off the press. Just now, I love this part of the session, the gut and stuff part of the session. It's always
sometimes you like them.
Yes, sometimes I like it.
I'll remember you said that.
We're going to hear about that in just a moment. So, Sasha, you want to come on up, and Ms. Chamberlain and Vicki Merkel. We got lots of Vickis this morning. Three in the same room.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work for Senator Ryan Deckert from Senate District 14. I am delighted to be here today to help present to you the revised version of a multicultural student-educator award program. After the first public hearing on February 8th, we convened a work group to address the concerns of various stakeholders and to strengthen the bill. I hope you'll find that what we present today is a stronger bill, more viable program, and it still speaks to the needs addressed in the original bill to encourage more diversity in the ranks of those who enter teaching programs, complete their course of study, and stay in Oregon to teach. As we heard in the wonderful expert testimony from Deborah Cochran, Dr. Algie Gatewood, and Dr. Peter Cookson, We have a schism in here in Oregon between the increasing diversity in our student bodies and that of our teachers. This bill, we hope, is a small step towards diversifying the teaching ranks, presenting more role models our students can identify with, and to encourage our diversifying student body that they too can succeed in the role of educators. As a work group, we met to address concerns of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and our expert witnesses, as well as concerns coming from the committee. I believe we have addressed many of these, and I'm delighted to be sitting here with Vicki Chamberlain from TSPC and Vicki Merkel from OSAC, who will describe in more depth the changes we made. And I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee, including questions about the Dash 2 amendments, after they conclude their testimony.
Okay. Can you clear up something for me, though? Because I went to get the testimony of Dr. Greatwood and all
yes.
those people, who, and it's not in this bill file. Because
in 443, right.
It's in another bill file.
And the reason we changed the number was because that was a relating to a student loan program. This, as in its new entity, is no longer a student loan program. Our office had another bill which was no longer viable, which had a relating to clause to higher education, which we used to make this new bill because of the issues that were brought up in the first hearing regarding the appropriation of money. And Vicki Merkel will talk about that.
Right. I'm trying to remember. I don't have my notes. If my staff is listening, can you please bring down Senate Bill 434. But I do remember that conversation.
Have a copy of the bill.
And I just need my notes.
Oh.
I like my own notes, thanks. You're gutting stuff in your own bill, so that's even more fun.
Yes.
Not quite as interesting, but we like the gutting stuff around here. Okay, so who wants to go next?
I actually want you to go first and talk about this.
Okay, great. Vicki, number one.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the director of Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And we're here in support of this bill. I can actually very quickly tell you what the Dash 2 changes are to the Dash 1 concepts. And
the Dash 2 replaces the Dash 1?
Right. And they're very minor. We asked for them for a couple reasons, just so that some accurate terms of art could be included in the statutory language and more clarification. So, for example, we asked that the word teachers be expanded to include all licensed educators. I mean, if the goal is to diversify the workforce, then all licensed educators would be eligible. The other thing that we asked is that the shortage areas that received the larger voucher include reading programs, which came up in the testimony on the other bill the first time, and English to students whose native tongue isn't English as an area to teach to receive a wider voucher, because we do have a shortage in those areas. So we asked to have that included, and that was included. Excuse me. And then there was one other, and that was on, that is now on page 3 in section 3 of the amendments. And on page, the very last page, right above section 5 there, we asked that the language, it said a participant must hold a bachelor's degree and be licensed to teach, and I ask that it say a non-provisional license, because we have a plethora of licenses for people who aren't appropriately licensed, and wanted to make sure that people who'd been through programs were the ones who were eligible for the vouchers. That said, we think that this is great legislation. I'm excited for you to hear from the Student Assistance Commission, because their concepts of not having this be a loan program that eventually you may have to collect and that people could default on and turning it into a voucher program is more likely to incent people into the program and to teach in these areas. And that by adding these endorsement areas and also focusing on a higher endorsement if the students end up teaching after they graduate in low-income schools is another enormous bonus and a great direction for Oregon to go. So if you have any questions related to the licensure pieces, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Senator Cruz popped his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to see if I can clarify this. For example, would a speech pathologist employed by an ESD qualify?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to get scope.
Yes. Okay. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to make sure that's clear on the record. And this was very important to us as well. On the very first page, the definition of teacher in our statute includes everyone that we license, including speech pathologists. It actually includes administrators, is how legislative council has interpreted that for us. So by having that definition in there expressly, made sure it included that population.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. No other questions, Ms. Merkel?
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Merkel. I am the Scholarship and Access Programs Director at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, located in Eugene, Oregon. I provided you with written testimony, and I won't be reading that, but I will highlight some of the talking points from that written testimony, and also provided you with a common scholarship application when I will discuss how we would recruit participants to this program for your reference. Changing this program from a loan forgiveness program to a student award voucher creates both an undergraduate incentive and a practitioner reward. This design borrows from a number of other programs that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission administers. For example, the loan repayment programs for nurses and rural practitioners that serve in critical areas and are given a monetary reward for each year of service. We also administer an AmeriCorps program that provides an educational voucher after a year of service. And our private scholarship program with the unified application provides us with experience in selection practices and involvement of the philanthropic community. The changes in Senate Bill 448 allow for the original objectives of this bill to be achieved without requiring students to become borrowers. While borrowing has become a necessity for most students, not every student or family or culture is comfortable with borrowing for an intangible such as education. A small recognition award is provided while the student is still in school as an incentive to participate. These scholarship recipients we know are encouraged because they get the message that someone believes in them. Often what we see in our private awards program is not a great deal of money that provides this sort of incentivization. But the student, we hear stories that students will put up their award letter on the wall of their dorm, and when things get tough, they'll look at that award letter and go, somebody believed in me enough to give me money, I'll go ahead, I'll make it through this last final or whatever and keep going through school. The service award voucher is a new concept for us, and what we're proposing is that this voucher be redeemed after each qualifying year of service for to be used in several different ways. Rather than in the original bill where it was to repay the loan, it could be used like our rural health program for loan repayment if the student had been a borrower, or for further education costs. Since you're incentivizing teachers, we know that teachers continue their education. Or a third way they could use this reward would be to establish a 529 plan either for themselves or a family member. That way you're broadening the participants who would be interested in being a part of this program and the ways that they could use their voucher. We also suggest that students redeem the student award voucher on an incremental basis, with the last award being the largest. And that's to provide a further incentive for teacher retention. And we understand from Vicki Chamberlain that often that fourth, fifth year of teaching is when it gets kind of rough. And if you can help a teacher stay, they'll participate in that career field for a longer time.
And I really have to tell you, I like that piece.
Okay.
That piece really grabbed me. I thought that was really clever.
OSAC, through our experience, is able to reach many students through our scholarship and outreach efforts. Last year, we distributed 50,000 of the common application booklets that I provided you statewide. They're distributed to every high school, college campus throughout the state of Oregon. We have proven experience in bringing applicants to donors, and in this case, the state of Oregon would be considered the donor, and in selecting recipients. The unified application packet gives the selection committee information about the student's demographic profile. Then we also collect four short essays that help students describe their goals and challenges. And in this program, we would ask for the additional diversity essay that asks students to describe their experiences with this diversity. And we collect a community service and work activities chart, transcripts, and test scores. On page 7 of the application booklet. It describes the diversity essay that will help us better understand the student who's applying and why they fit the bill's proposed goal of serving students from diverse populations. We also believe that private donors may be interested in supporting this program. Many donors want to help underserved students achieve their dreams through education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Being kind of quiet this morning. Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 3, page 3 of the dash 2s. Yeah, dash 2. Page 2, lines 10 through 20, those six criteria, must all of them be met in order for an applicant to qualify, or are these just illustrative of the things that would be considered?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, those are factors that should be looked at. I do not, as it is my understanding, that those are not criteria that must all be met. They are factors that should be looked at when awarding the vouchers.
Any other questions? Senator Westland.
Well, just a comment. When you get back home to Eugene, could you give a great big hello and thank you to Kathy Wiper for her years of tireless work on the TSPC? Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, so we're looking at the dash 2. I have my file from before. I love it when my staff is listening, which they do a lot of, and they just respond like that. And so we did have fabulous testimony, colleagues. That was back on February 8th. And have you talked to Senator Gordon Lee? I haven't seen her here, but have you kept her in the loop about the changes? Because she did testify.
Chair Walker, yes, we have. We have kept her in the loop. She was pleased with the dash twos. There were a couple of things that, and I did want to mention this on the record, there were a couple of issues that were brought up, particularly by Dr. Gatewood, mm-hmm. issues that he wanted addressed that you do not see in this dash two. We did talk about those in the work group. One specifically was increasing the interest rate on a loan. Obviously, that's not an issue now that it's not a loan program. There was so that was one of the things that you don't see here because of the change in the distribution of monies. But I, as far as I know, Senator Gordley is, she has expressed pleasure with the way that the bill turned out, and especially that it seems to serve the issues that the original bill was aimed to serve, and in a kind of a better distribution.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm looking here at the other suggested changes that Dr. Gatewood had made, and one of them was to target prospective teachers in high school. And do you believe that you've successfully done that here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Vicki Chamberlain, TSPC again. I think that when you talk about single subjects, that just sort of necessarily hones in on high school, like math and science. We don't tend to think of math and science discreetly in the elementary areas. Reading, however, would go toward the elementary areas where we need it the most, where we've learned, obviously, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen the latest statistics, but we've been able to divert a lot of children out of special education by making sure that they're reading at grade level by the grade of 3. That's why that investment's very good. But there isn't any specificity here in terms of preferring high school over other buildings. So if it, I need to be honest.
Okay. Sasha?
Sasha Pollack again. I actually think Dr. Gatewood's issue was looking at prospective teachers in high school, if I'm remembering his testimony correctly, and trying to target them to guide them into a program. And I think we talked about that in the work group. I know we talked about it in the work group, and I think the decision was it was too amorphous, and it would be a very large job to expand the program to encourage folks at a younger age than the college age to participate in this program, and it would be much more difficult to keep track of them over that up to, you know, 5 or 7 years that they would be in the educational process.
Mm-hmm. I found his testimony, his written testimony, and he wanted to target prospective teachers in high school and assist them throughout their 4 years of undergraduate study. Would extend the maximum loan amount. We're not talking about a loan program anymore, but it would get more students interested in the profession, allow for greater parental and guardian involvement, and provide access to students who have the desire but not the financial resources to complete the first year of college. And I guess that's why I like that last piece that gives them more money at the end if they stay in the program. It's sort of an incentive. It isn't sort of, it is. Ms. Merkel?
Chair Walker, members of the committee. Also, by providing a scholarship for the students' last 2 years of college, we feel that was the appropriate point to encourage and incentivize a student to apply and participate in the program. If you're asking students while they're still in high school, you do face the opportunity that that student may take to change their major, and I think currently the average is 3 times that a student will change their major. So we wanted to have them enter at a time when they're more likely to follow the career path into teaching.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Vicki Chamberlain, sorry I misunderstood the question, but another relevant point is 75% of our Oregon graduates from teacher education or other education programs come through master's degree programs. So going back to high school is even more difficult. We have mm-hmm. just a very few undergraduate teacher preparation programs, and we have a built-in incentive for those that we do have for the junior and senior year, but to keep a high school student engaged all the way through an undergraduate degree that isn't directly related to education would be extremely difficult the way we have it structured right now in Oregon.
Okay, great. All right, Senator Morris has a question now.
Thank you. As I read this, a student could receive a total of $29,000 in voucher assistance.
Senator Walker.
The dash twos.
Senator Morris, no, $15,000, I believe it's the. I don't have the dash.
If I read the language correct, Madam Chair, page 3, line 22, in addition to the service award vouchers awarded under subsection 1, the previous section, the Commission shall award, and it looks like it's additive in its language.
There's. Two paths that the student can. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Walker, members of the committee. too much cold medication this morning. I'm not remembering my. A student can either fulfill their obligation through a 3-year pathway or a 4-year pathway, depending upon the type of teaching that they choose. So it's either or. So I think what perhaps you're doing is adding both of those pathways together. But
if I may, Senator Morris, in addition to the vouchers awarded under subsection 1, it doesn't add subsection 1s and 2 and 3. I'm sorry if I'm not speaking directly to your question.
Well, I read this as if they're potentially available, both of them, both sections.
Yes, okay.
1 and section. Or section 2, section 1, 2, and 3. Oh, excuse me, section 1. Okay, I got you. So it's total of 15,000. I apologize.
Okay, we got that cleared up.
Got that cleared.
Okay. All right, thank you, ladies. I appreciate the testimony. There's no other public testimony. Is the committee feeling like they can go into work session on this bill?
We'll be going to Ways and Means, right?
Yes, it will. Okay, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 448. Open a work session on Senate Bill 448.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 448.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 448. Any questions, discussion? Okay, those are approved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 448 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 448 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz,
Madam
to your
Chair.
Motion.
Well, just a concern as we're moving from a loan program, which would be a revolving account, to a direct allocation. I mean, that's just a concern I wanted to put on the table. But the other bill is down there, so the Ways and Means folks would have the opportunity to go either way on this based on revenue. So.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, you want to take the roll, Ms. Prevelle? It's been a while.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Westman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. It's on its way. Senate Bill 448, having received the majority, is on its way to Ways and Means, where we will see it again, Senator Morse. Okay, we are going to now, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 753.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 753 requires all executive department agencies and officers to cooperate with an ombudsman established by law or by another state agency or officer. It refers disputes related to instances in which ombudsman requests information to the Attorney General.
Okay, that's a hard word to say, ombudsman, ombudsman. All right, say it 20 times, backwards and forwards. Senator Morissette, are you here on Senate Bill 753?
He is, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And do you want who do you want to come up with you at this time? Pick a number, pick a person. Two beautiful ladies, all right. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, here to talk about a bill for the ombuds person. How's that?
Yeah, what it says.
Ombudsman. Right.
Yeah, I just realized that's a little sexist.
It is. So I call them ombuds persons, but that's not part of the bill.
All right, maybe I'll drop a priority bill about that one.
Okay. We could always amend it.
We could amend it too. All right.
Just a little bit of background. There are a number of bills for ombuds persons. We have a long term. Well, we have one for capitated health plans. That's been introduced. That's in Senator Montesanto's committee, Senate Bill 360. There was a hearing yesterday concerning mental health ombuds person. The testimony said if we had someone, we would not possibly have those thousands of canisters sitting over at the mental health hospital. If there had been a person to represent the interest of the families, that might not be a problem. There is a position that currently is not being funded for corrections. If we had an ombudsman that was working with corrections, the food issue probably would have come up long ago because there were complaints about the food.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened until this thing came to a head. The position, I think, is essential, and the origin of the word is, I think it's a Scandinavian word that means, in a sense, cutting through the red tape, going to the heart of the matter, getting the information, acting upon it, going to the head of the agency, so to speak, and getting what you need to resolve issues. I have two ombuds persons with me this morning to testify. The system is not broken, but it's very weak, rather vague. It's very difficult to find out how many there are, actually. There are some official ones. There are some non-official. Well, there are a lot of volunteers, and they have a varying degree of authority, which is also kind of vague. So the purpose of this bill is to give some certainty and some definition and try to... we're not trying to expand the program, but we're trying to make it more credible, so to speak, and more dependable and more certain. So with that, I would defer to Naomi. Would you?
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Naomi Steenson. I'm the administrator for the Governor's Advocacy Office. This office holds the Department of Human Service Ombudsman as well as the Children's Ombudsman, and I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 753. Our office serves as an ombudsman for all the Department of Human Service programs and services. However, long-term care services that are facility-related, we do turn over to the Office of the Ombudsman for the Long-Term Care. In addition, our office investigates civil rights complaints, and those that fall under a federal jurisdiction are referred elsewhere, but we do track and monitor those. We also monitor the Department for Americans with Disability Act compliance, especially in the case of reasonable accommodations and alternate format communications. The role ombudsmen play in state government is invaluable for ensuring Oregonians that they're given a neutral and unbiased investigation or review of their complaints about program benefits or services. Ombudsman offices also serve as an informal tool to hold state agencies and other entities accountable to their mission and policies. And the level of service that we as ombudsmen can provide is precisely dependent on the cooperation and response from the relevant state agencies in providing the necessary paperwork and relevant information. At the Governor's Advocacy Office, we're fortunate to have access to most of the online client information systems. And so in simple cases, very often by just looking that information up, we can go ahead and resolve a situation without even having to contact the office. But then again, in the more complex cases where we need hard file documents to be accessed or we need to do interviews, it can be very problematic at times, especially when contacting a Department of Human Service contractor office, such as a local mental health authority or developmental disability services. In the cases where we do run into hesitation or resistance in responding and providing the information, we either use that as an educational opportunity to let people know what we are about and what their obligation is to provide with documents, or we are compelled to go to a higher authority to mandate release of those documents. Our history has shown that the more respect and sense of fairness that we can show the state site that we're involved with, even if the findings aren't in their favor, we usually can eventually build some trust and ensure future cooperation with them. We do have to, as ombudsman, assure that cases are in compliance with policies, the individual was treated fairly, given due process, and that they are provided with an unbiased second-level review of the situation and the appropriate outcome or resolution occurs. In meeting with different disciplines of ombudsmen throughout the Pacific Northwest, it's always acknowledged that the effectiveness of the ombudsman's office is contingent on their ability to access information and cooperation from the organizations that fall within their jurisdiction. State agencies are obliged to have a cooperative working relationship with their associated ombudsman for the best interests of all Oregonians, the ones we serve, and to inspire continued public confidence in our government systems. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll hear next before we ask questions from Meredith.
Senator Walker, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. And the state long-term care ombudsman investigates and resolves complaints made on behalf of long-term care residents. We monitor the laws and rules around long-term care as they affect the residents of long-term care facilities, and we advocate for changes that improve residents' lives. And currently, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, in its enabling statute, does have access to the records of all public agencies as are necessary to the duties of the office. But what I would like to do today is talk to why I think this bill We are here to support Senate Bill 753 and why I think it augments the access that the long-term care ombudsman already has in statute. I'd also like at the end of my testimony to talk about some changes to the bill before you that have been agreed upon by all the parties that are here today advocating on behalf of the bill. First of all, and typically, the long-term care ombudsman, most of our information requests go to facilities because we are investigating resident complaints, and so we are asking for confidential information as it relates to residents. But we do make frequent requests to the Department of Human Services for Adult Protective Services reports, for example, and those are the reports that evidence an investigation of abuse or neglect. And we refer just under about 800 complaints of abuse or neglect to the department each year, and we follow up on those. So a lot of times we're asking for the confidential portion so that we can review the investigation that occurred. Where it becomes more challenging to access information from the department is when we are investigating a system that appears to not be functioning according to law or rule. For example, an entire adult protective services system. And then we're not so much asking for a discrete record, but we're asking for information about what is happening with this system, why there are problems, why our adult protective services referrals are not being investigated by the local agency. And we find that when we do that and we're actually getting into an issue that is so not so much about a particular resident in a facility but is about a system, that is much more difficult to get timely information from the department. And sometimes that's because they may not attach any priority to the ombudsman request. Because they're all hard at work doing the things that are important to that agency. Other times it may be that the ombudsman has hit something that is of concern to them as well, and it's difficult to determine on their part what should be said to the ombudsman and what should not be. So what this bill does that our current Access Authority doesn't is it actually looks at information versus just documents. It requires cooperation and to requests about information. And so I think that in the cases that I've just described, it usually takes an enormous amount of time and persistence by the ombudsman to get the kind of information that they need, time that, frankly, I'd like to be spending somewhere else. And so this bill would assist that. And so that's why I support this bill. And I'd like to just talk to you a moment before I conclude my remarks about the sort of changes in the bill that I think and okay. The group thinks would enhance it.
Okay.
On line 10 of the bill, where it says all agencies, officers of the executive department.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, do you have copies of the bill?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. As defined by ORS 174-112 shall, it would be helpful to add the word promptly. Cooperate with an ombudsman established by law.
And we're being handed a redlined version right now.
Okay, so you do in fact have the version that I am talking about?
Right, with your handwritten notes.
Okay.
And then on line 11 and 12, it deletes certain language or designated by another state agency or officer. And then further down on line 14, in order to just have the Attorney General involved in those issues which are legal in nature, it substitutes a legal for the word any on line 14, and on 15 substitutes the word may for the word should. And those are changes that I believe the Department of Human Services, Senator Morissette's office, and our office,
and the Attorney General's office. Mr. Shepherd in the back nodding his head because I was thinking, what a nightmare if any dispute was sent over to the AG's office.
And from the standpoint of a small agency, I have to tell you that the AG bills that might incur frighten me as well.
Oh, yeah, so that's huge.
so
they don't work for cheap, you know. They actually don't get paid very well, but that's beside the point. It does add a lot to the bill for the agency.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
Also, I like that was a concern I had if we're giving this authority to ombudsmen designated by a state agency, limited into those that we have created and established by law. I think is a good fix as well.
Yeah.
So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks. And
okay, great. Senator Morse has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The ORS 174.112 defines the executive department. And I'm wondering why we wouldn't expand this to include local units of government that are contractors and extension of state agencies.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I would be wholeheartedly supportive of that because in our particular statute, we have the long-term care ombudsman has access to the records of all public agencies. So that would affect local government. And quite frankly, some of the most resistance to access of those records has come from local agencies versus executive branch agencies. So I would certainly, I don't know how, and I think that Naomi in her comments did in fact reference some of the local offices as well and contractors. So we certainly would support an expansion in that direction.
Madam Chair, I would recommend that we consider mm-hmm. since we're working the bill and mm-hmm. conceptual amendments here, that we consider that expansion.
I couldn't agree with you more, Senator Morse, because I'm telling you, if it wasn't for the ombudsman offices, we'd be in a world of hurt. We can't respond to every single constituent in terms of digging down deep into the agency and finding out what the real problem is. I mean, we can make phone calls, we can write letters, we can make visits to the agency, and we do all of those things. But we represent 114,000 constituents, and we don't have the time to dig deep. And you are entrusted to do that, and that's why you get resistance sometimes from these agencies, because they don't want you to know what's really going on. So we really value what the ombudsman's offices do, and that's a very good suggestion.
Madam Chair, in the long-term care ombudsman office, as I indicated, it says access to the records of all public agencies, and I don't know whether Pete Shepard from the Justice Department has a better term to encompass what Senator Morse has requested.
Well, we'll ask Mr. Shepard because we're running way behind now, so we need to really speed it along. I want to thank you for your testimony. I'm going to pop Mr. Shepard up here to answer that question, and then Senator Morse, if you can work with Senator Morissette on your question.
This is a good bill.
It's, yeah.
It's a godsend
to the legislators.
Let me just put it bluntly.
Well,
thank you, Senator.
I know, the whole time I'm sitting there, yes, 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 how many cases have I had where it would have been great had we had greater cooperation? Mr. Shepard, state your name and give us a little two-minute story. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I have to say that if the handwritten document you were handed earlier was, it's my handwriting, so if you can't read it, don't blame Meredith.
Actually read that pretty well. Thank you.
We support the bill and the amendments, and I won't speak further to the bill or to the amendments you've already discussed. I do want to speak very briefly to Senator Morse's suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably not the best person to technically help you describe the scope, the expansion of line 10 and 11 to the other agencies. I think Legislative Council probably can help you and Senator Morissette more effectively with that. I would ask you, suggest to the committee, however, that if you choose to expand line 10 to more than merely the agencies that are described in the existing language, that you should nevertheless leave the limitation in lines 13 and 14 that requires agencies or officers of the executive department to consult with the Attorney General if there is a legal dispute. The reason for that is we don't want to, the Attorney General's office cannot represent any local entity that might get involved in a legal dispute with an ombudsperson.
Okay, very good point.
So we wouldn't want to change lines 13 and 14 if you do make the policy change you discussed in lines 10 at 11.
Okay.
I think that was 2 minutes, Madam Chair.
That was less than 2 minutes, and it was very succinct. Thank you. So I think that gets us started. So I'll have the two senators work with this. And thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Always a pleasure to see you. Okay, I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 753, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 779.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 779 requires school districts to establish a complaint process, allows an appeal to the superintendent of public instruction if the school district process is not followed, declares an emergency and take effect July 1st, 2007. You also have a dash one in front of you that I'll speak to as well.
Okay.
The dash one amendment replaces the substantive provisions of the measure. It leaves in place when it would apply and the emergency clause. It requires school districts to establish a complaint process as well. It requires the school district to follow its complaint process. It specifies the complaint process timelines required in the complaint resolution process. It requires school districts to submit their complaint resolution process to the superintendent for review. It requires the complainant to either exhaust the district's complaint resolution procedures or for the deadline of the complaint resolution process to pass prior to appealing to the superintendent for public instruction. It requires the superintendent to find the school district deficient if the complaint resolution process is not followed or if standards under state law or under administrative rule are violated.
Okay. Nina Bell, Margaret DeLacy, and last name of Love, I think it's Jill. Sue, okay, I can't read that. I will fix it. S-U-E. Okay, ladies, we have one more bill we're going to hear today. So if you have written testimony, please don't read it. Just summarize it. And we have one person signed up and two people signed up in opposition. The School Board Association and the Confederation of School Administrators. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
I'll go first.
Great, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here and to have my voice back.
Oh, last time you were here, you were quite sick, like the rest of us.
And I want to thank you for holding this hearing, and I would also like to give special thanks to your staff and to the Legislative Council's office that's worked with us in developing the amendments to this bill.
Great, and you'll state your name.
My name, for the record, is Margaret DeLacy.
Thank you.
I live in Multnomah County, Portland, School District, and I'm here on my own behalf and not on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted.
Okay, great.
We do not regard this as a tag bill, although we've encountered these issues as tag parents.
Right.
And I would also like to say that the three of us are absolutely filled with envy when we hear about the Ombudsman program, because we are also dealing with a large state agency which does not have an ombudsman and a complaint process which is completely broken.
Wow, so it's a nice segue into this bill.
I think so. We have not been able to make the complaint process work in order to obtain an appropriate education for our children. And this process has been going on now from the time of my first written complaint for over 13 years. The other parents who co-signed this complaint have also been in the process for a similar amount of time. And so far, none of us have seen significant improvements in the education that our children have received. An education system which has been found twice by state investigations to be inadequate, and the third is still under litigation. I am not going to read my testimony, but I would like to read a little bit from the beginning, which explains why we feel that the complaint process needs to be addressed. In 1997, I and a group of other TAG parents filed a complaint with the state of Oregon concerning the implementation of the TAG mandate in Portland. In our appeal, we included evidence of excessive delays by our district in violation of its own written complaint procedures. And in the testimony that I've just distributed, there is a copy of the district complaint procedure. The Portland complaint procedure seems to me to be a relatively reasonable and straightforward procedure had the district followed it, which they did not.
Okay.
For example, although district procedures require that region directors at the time they were, I believe they were region directors, the name of that official has undergone several transformations as the district is reorganized. It requires them to respond to written complaints within 7 days. We sent a letter to our region director on June 5th, 1995. It was answered 3 months later. Our complaint procedure allows 2 weeks for a superintendent to reach a decision about an appeal. We waited 82 days for that decision. My own part in the Portland complaint began with a letter to my own school dated March 31st, 1994. This should have been resolved within approximately a month. In fact, my complaint was still unresolved when our group as a whole appealed to the Oregon Department of Education on January 8th, 1997. A process that should have taken less than a month actually stretched out over more than 3 years and was still unresolved. During that time, my children who were in middle school, one of them, I believe, went all the way through middle school while waiting for some solution. When they considered our appeal concerning tag services to the department, the superintendent of public instruction stated that they could not address the section of our complaint about undue delays by the district in resolving complaints because, quote, policies and procedures regarding communication and timelines for resolution of complaints are matters of district policy and are not mandated by state law. In other words, they were telling us the districts must have complaint procedures, but they don't have to follow them. There is a law that requires them to have these procedures. They don't have to pay attention to them. Because of the publicity that our appeal attracted, I've heard from other TAG parents who've also been very frustrated by their difficulty in having complaints resolved. Some of them are here to talk with you today. But I really don't see this as just a TAG issue. Department of Education is an extremely large section of the state. It expends a huge fraction of state funding. There are many other parents who are extremely frustrated by their inability to resolve well-founded complaints in a timely manner. I'm sure the ombudsman could tell you that any large state agency is going to create well-founded complaints, and it's in everybody's interest, everybody's, including the agencies, that these complaints be addressed and resolved in ways that serve both the needs of the people who are being served by the agency, their families, and the agency itself. The bill has been amended. I was planning to go over the features of the bill as amended, but as your administrator has also already done an excellent job of summarizing the amendments, I won't go over that.
Okay.
I had a final section in which I talked about why school districts should follow their own written procedures. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I don't see much point in doing that. I think all of us agree that state agencies that have written policies and procedures should follow them. Failure to do
sort
so.
Sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense. My children go to school. They have to obey the school rules. They're not given any options about it. And I honestly think it sets a terrible example for them and for the rest of us when school districts fail to follow their own rules, which they, unlike my children, were able to write themselves. Okay. So if you want, you can look at the reasons, but I won't go over them in any detail. I'm going to turn the floor over to the two women who are with me,
okay,
who've had similar problems more recently.
Okay. And ladies, again, please don't read your testimony. Just sort of summarize it because we have to hear this other bill before we close down today. So who'd like to go next?
I'll go. my name is Nina Bell, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I live in Portland. I have two children who have been in the public schools there since 1992, and I support Senate Bill 779 as set out in the proposed amendments that came out last night. Yes, I too see this through the particular lens of the talented and gifted programs or lack thereof, but it's my view that that these processes in the bill are needed for any parent in any district looking to enforce any standard that the state has. Because the problem is this, that a parent who is in a school district who is not meeting state standards has only one remedy, and that is to file a complaint with the school district itself. And at this particular point, contrary to the plain meaning of the OARs that govern this, if the district chooses not to act on that complaint or to take forever to act on it, which has the same effect in a child's life, the parent has no recourse. Parents, in my mind, are a little bit like whistleblowers that I look at in terms of like federal whistleblower protection. whistleblowers like and parents are on the front line and able to see when state standards haven't been met, and to make sure that districts are held accountable. Without parents being able to do that, there are very few opportunities to ensure that state standards, in fact, are met. So just to illustrate briefly from my personal experience, I and others first filed a complaint in 2002, which was ultimately abandoned, and then subsequently filed a second complaint early this school year. This, again, was regarding a program for TAG students. In this particular case, we alleged a number of egregious violations of state standards, ranging from things that have nothing to do with TAG, but things like failure to meet the minimum number of instructional hours and teach mandatory health topics and meet basic state requirements for alternative ed programs, and also to meet the state's TAG mandate. We filed our complaint a mere 5 weeks into the school year. Had the District of Portland followed its own board-adopted complaint procedure, we would have received a complete response by the school board itself by November 30th, which is slightly under 60 days from the filing of the complaint, just to keep it in perspective in terms of how this bill now reads. Instead, the district has stalled at every turn, despite all sorts of letter writing and meetings and what have you that we've had with them. And to date, it has still not issued the report that would allow the Portland School Superintendent to make recommendations to the school board. In other words, this entire school year will have passed before the district answers the complaint, let alone addresses any of the identified problems. Due to frustration with the district not meeting its timeframes in its complaint procedure, in December of last year, in November, we filed an appeal of that complaint with the Oregon Department of Education. But that December, it rejected the appeal, basically stating that its rules precluded its accepting the appeal. However, its rules specifically call, and I've quoted them in the written testimony, specifically call for a process that allows parents to appeal when the district has not taken timely action. Instead, the ODE wrote to us and stated that it had basically took an entirely opposite view of what the OARs state in plain language. And that is basically why Senate Bill 779 is needed, to compel districts to have timely complaint procedures, to compel them to abide by those procedures, and to provide recourse to parents if districts refuse to follow those procedures. ODE also told us in a letter refusing to accept our appeal, it then subsequently said that we had articulated our position clearly, and while not allowing that they had jurisdiction to accept our appeal, they accepted it anyway, which I find slightly mind-boggling. But in any case, they announced in this letter to us that they intended to conduct rulemaking to change the OARs to conform to their new view, which would preclude parents from appealing a complaint on which a district was taking no action, and would actually require parents to wait 45 days until a district had taken action, which could frankly be never. There is no reason why a district would need to meet its own requirements. There is no policy rationale for ODE reading the OARs in this way, and in not providing any recourse to parents where districts ignore complaints or requiring parents to wait 45 days. And in my written testimony, I make some reference to the reason for waiting periods, which are frankly fairly common in environmental laws, for example. The plain meaning of the OAR is exactly what is needed from a policy standpoint now, a procedure with the ODE that provides timely recourse for parents whose attempts to pressure school districts to comply with state standards are rebuffed, ignored, or not addressed in a timely manner. I urge you to put the intent of OAR 581-022-1940 subsection 2 into statute by passing Senate Bill 779. And I thank you for the opportunity to address the committee, and I would be open to any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to hear from Ms. Love. I'm going to limit you to 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Susan Love.
and I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, and this morning I've come to speak in support of Senate Bill 779. I've provided you with written testimony, and in addition, I've attached written testimony from another parent that unfortunately cannot be here today because she's working on IEPs for students within the school district. When parents file a complaint, it is a decision that is not made lightly, and it is far from easy and can be very discouraging for parents to walk through. In fact, I can't even imagine someone who has a language barrier or some other type of barrier or doesn't have a group of other parents to work with to support them to work through the process that we have worked through in our school district to file a complaint. I have copies, only single copies, and I went online this morning. And in fact, at one point, the complaint form was online. I couldn't even find it this morning. I looked for a half an hour on the school district website. So you can go drive down to the offices, and sometimes that can be a real barrier for parents because they may want to just pick the complaint form up without making a big scene or being labeled that they're picking up a complaint. Often when parents come to make a complaint, they do it after numerous attempts to work with school district staff and to improve and right the situation for their student or other students and even students within the state. It is a frustrating situation for parents. It takes an emotional toll. It requires a great support system. Fortunately for our group of parents, we've had a very good support system, and we've become friends because of it. We've become stronger. Our kids have become stronger. We've tried to model gracious advocacy for our students so that they will be able to do this as adults and not feel like they need to be quiet about something when they see something is wrong. By filing complaints, parents often take a big, brave step and hope that someone will actively listen and respond appropriately and in a timely manner. And when my son saw Senate Bill 779, he said, "Mom, make sure they define what prompt is," because it's in the beginning of the, and he's 14 years old, and he read through it, and he said, "They need to define prompt because it's not moving fast enough. We're sitting in the classrooms and a whole school year goes by." At our group of parents, we began this whole process in March of 2006. We actually filed our complaint on May 23rd, 2006 and received a final letter from the school board of October of this year. We're still dealing with many, many issues. We have not come to any kind of agreement at this point.
Okay.
Senate Bill 779, along with its proposed amendments, establishes much-needed calendar guidelines and calls for a process to be established in writing for the prompt resolution of a complaint. As a parent and citizen of Oregon, I hope that we can move to and reach this important goal for all, but especially for Oregon citizens and students. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. I know we've had this discussion before about being labeled as problem parents.
Yes.
And I think I'd like to, I don't know why the department's not here today to talk about why they don't care, but it's for school districts, so we have the folks here to talk about that. Any questions from the committee? I appreciate your advocacy, all of you, and thank you for coming and testifying, and we'll hear from some folks right behind you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Green and Mr. Bennett, let me preface it by saying you are displacing the Senate President's bill.
Does this make them the tag team?
Yes. It's a very good joke. All right, we're not hearing Senate Bill 967 today. It's not a do or die thing that we got to get done today. And so we're going to just finish up with your testimony. So between the two of you, let's take about 5 minutes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. And I can't speak for what's gone on in the Portland School District or in the Salem School District or what's gone on at the Oregon Department of Education.
Okay.
I would suggest the committee that you call those school districts, have them come down and explain what's gone on with the complaints that have been filed by the women sitting behind me. I don't know anything about them. But what I can tell you about Senate Bill 779 and the Dash 1 amendments is that it does cast too broad of a web over a complaint process. I think what you're hearing about is a complaint around it, surrounding the Division 22 standards. And the Division 22 standards are Oregon administrative rules promulgated by the Department of Education that say when a school district is considered to be, quote-unquote, a standard school district and not. But the problem with the amendments, as I see them, is this would give the ability for anybody to come in and complain about any action that a school board would take. And some of those actions need to occur pretty rapidly, like changing a bus route, dealing with a school lunch program, when school hours begin. Some of those decisions are made by a school board because that's the people who have to make those decisions. They're publicly elected. They hold their public hearings on those things. I think what they're trying to get at are Division 22 issues. The problem I see with the amendments is it casts too broad of a web over which they could complain any action that a school board may take. Now, I don't have a problem if folks want to come in and complain to my members about you're a locally elected official and we don't think you ought to go out for a school bond. That's what they hold those public hearings about on those things. But the process that's set up in here, I think creates too broad of a web and would create some huge problems in our school districts, particularly when you start running it under ORS 327-103, which gives the state superintendent of public instruction, as you have in front of you, the ability to start pulling state school funds from school districts. Obviously, I think that's a pretty heady step, but if you're looking at Division 22 standards, that's something I think we can talk about. The other thing I see in the dash ones, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Bennett, is filing another piece of paper with the State Department of Education. Hey, you're asking us to put our complaint process before the State Department of Education. Fine. They won't look at it, and it's just another step we've got to go through to mail another piece of paper to the Department of Education, which takes time and resources. I think if you had the Department of Education here, they'd tell you they wouldn't have anybody to take a look at it even if we sent it over to them. So I'm not quite sure why that's in the process here. One of the other things I would say real quickly, some of the timelines in here, I think we need to know also from the Department of Education what their timelines are. And I don't think timelines are going to be a problem. I would like to hear from those school districts as to what the issue was with the complaints that were received by the lady sitting behind me. Again, I don't know what they are, but I can tell you that Mr. Bennett and I are in the building all the time. We would have loved to have worked on some amendments to this bill to make it a workable bill, but as the amendments are right now, we just think it casts too broad of a web, and we'd be willing to sit down and talk to folks about it, but we weren't asked.
Okay, well, you're going to be asked in a few minutes. Thanks for offering.
You shall receive.
That's exactly right. Okay, Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, I certainly second Mr. Green's comments on the net being cast and also trying to understand if this is about school hours and bus routes, TAG, or Division 22 rules. We're not clear where the problems do lie that were talked about. Like Mr. Green, I can't speak for Portland Public Schools or Salem Public Schools, and certainly with the vague description of the problem, my understanding, I guess, was that these are TAG-related issues, and we certainly have enough vehicles dealing with TAG to discuss it. But this bill, Madam Chair, I guess you kind of get to the bottom line on penalties, and the bottom line is apparently the way you would punish a school district is to withhold funds from kids, and that's the part I find most difficult to understand. It's kind of the nuclear option for folks who do not like where the bus is stopping in their neighborhood, and I think that's just not the way we have dealt with these kinds of issues. To withhold the state school funds over time of day school starts, school lunches, school bus routes, the whole raft of complaints that can come into a school district office, I think, just doesn't make sense. Certainly, when you get to some of the really fundamental issues involving standards, we believe that those options do exist, and we'll be glad to sit down with the proponents of the bill to examine the statute and the rules to see where we can make the changes necessary to accomplish, we hope, the kind of solutions offered here on important issues involving children's education. I guess the other issue that gets a little frustrating, Madam Chair, is representing school administrators. Thank you for the potential for a full employment bill for my guys. This is the kind of thing that fills up school central offices with a whole batch of activities if exercised on a regular basis. Again, this needs to be crafted in such a way. We're dealing with really fundamental issues of children's education and not with just some sort of operations-related issues for school districts, particularly when you're talking about withholding funding for children's education. So we stand ready with Mr. Green to sit down with you or whomever to see if we can figure out what the problem is here. It would also be helpful to really understand what the issues were at Salem Public School and Portland Public Schools to see if this is the issue being resolved here. Sometimes these issues were not resolved to folks' satisfaction, and we see statutes like this. So we really, I think, have at least should have the opportunity to examine what the history of the problems are here.
And, Madam Chair, if I could add, if it is your desire to do a work group or get folks together on this, I would encourage you to bring folks in from the Portland Public Schools and the Sam Kaiser School District to discuss their process. And, I mean, we can sit here and talk about a broad statewide spectrum, but we're not day-to-day involved in school districts. And I think it'd be good to have, if you're going to put a work group together, somebody from a school district perspective, and I think also from the Oregon Department of Education. Madam Chair, I agree with you. I wish they were here today to answer for some of this, but I think you need to have a perspective from a school district person as to whether a process that can be devised by statute will work in a school district so that we do have a process set up by where parents can make complaints and those can be handled by a school district in a matter that will satisfy both parties. And sometimes that's not going to happen. And one of the things that we've always encouraged our school districts to do is look at alternative dispute resolution processes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for that to be part of the discussion as well. But again, I think the bill and its amendments cast just too broad of a web right now, and we'd be willing to sit down and work with the advocates on the bill. I understand you're a sponsor of the bill, so I'd like to talk to you about some of the provisions in there as well.
Okay, thank you. I am a sponsor of the bill, but I'm going to slough this one off to Senator Metzger, and I don't say that in a negative way. It's just like right now I've got so many work groups. I forgot about one of them yesterday and was 10 minutes late for it. Well, I knew about it, but it just slipped my mind because there were so many other things. So I slipped a note to Senator Metzger. His office has agreed to work with you all and see if we can try to find something that might work. And I don't know why the Department of Ed isn't here. Dana indicated that she talked to them yesterday. Senator Cruz has a question.
Well, just if there's a work group, some concerns with language, and I would agree. I think there needs to be a definition of complaints so we know the universe we're talking about.
Right.
And then on page 2, lines 1 and 7, it would make more sense to me if we're it says 30 days of the resumption of the school in the fall. I would assume you're meaning after resumption, and I think it should say that. And then I have a real question with what sort of complaint does not require that school be in session, looking specifically at a lot of small schools who, when school's over, there's nobody there for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think many of these complaints come from the tag issue, and that's why I've asked Senator Metzger to do it, though there are others. But you're right, it is broad, and I'm not interested in withholding money from school districts because they haven't been able to meet the complaint. So, okay, with that, thank you. Mr. Lacey, your
Madam
hand's
Chair.
Up. Mr. Lacey, come on up. Well,
point of personal privilege.
Uh-huh.
How about them Dodgers?
All right, Mr. Lacey, quickly, what is something you'd like to address?
Madam Chair, I believe that this bill sets a timeline to respond to a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a complaint about a school bus or whatever, I still fail to understand, since Portland's own process takes approximately 60 days, and that's considerably less than the time we've allowed, I don't understand why a school district can't be expected to respond to that complaint within its timeline. That's all we're asking them to do.
All right.
We are not asking them to settle every complaint in the parent's favor. We're just asking for a response in a timely manner.
Okay. I know that the School Boards Association sets up model policies all the time, so you guys can have a discussion in the work group. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 779, and I'm going to close the committee and adjourn for today.